KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
It's been hot and sunny summer. This is Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. Our gardeners come up and tell you how to grow everything that isn't growing already in your garden. That's coming up later this hour on the show. The primary election is on August 6th. Ballots will begin to arrive in your mailboxes this week. Seattle voters choose between nine people who want to be mayor of the city. KUOW is talking with all nine of those candidates this week on Weekday in the Conversation. The interviews will be archived at our website, kuow.org/elections. Douglas McQuaid is a West Seattle resident, and he's a late entrant to the race. He ran an unsuccessful campaign last year for state Supreme Court. McQuaid is a combat veteran and an attorney in private practice. Although we did invite him to our studios, Mr. McQuaid was unable to make it here in person. We caught up with him by cell phone on his way to Seattle Municipal Court to represent a client. I asked him how he'd assess the progress the city's made so far in compliance with the Justice Department's consent agreement to reform the Seattle Police Department.
I haven't seen any major changes made, and I think the initial reaction to the Department of Justice was not correct, because if the Department of Justice, which is part of the federal government, says we want to monitor your program, they should cooperate fully, allow them to monitor their program. And this guy, Merrick Bob, they should never have contested him, because he was chosen by them, and he's an expert on the subject. And just cooperate fully and let them do their job, and hopefully the police department of the city of Seattle will become, the culture will change, and it will become more oriented toward their primary duty, which is protect and serve the citizens of the state, not arrest and convict and use force against ordinary citizens.
If you were elected, what would be your first step in trying to make sure that the police department is reformed?
Well, the first step would be finding of a chief of police who is very, very sensitive to the area of community involvement and helping to help the citizens as much as possible, and to use as least force as necessary to apprehend any bad guys or criminals. But don't treat everyone like a criminal, and there are people with mental problems, and they should be dealt separately, and there are ways of negotiating and dealing with them, and so they should change the culture of the police force of Seattle, and that can be done by getting a chief of police who is very, very sensitive to the needs of the people. This is a city of the people, by the people, and for the people.
Sort of related to that, we have a lot of mentally ill homeless, and we do have a big problem with homelessness in general. Recently, the mayor and city council decided that they would shut down the homeless camp known as Nicholsville for good and try to find housing for the residents. Do you think that was the right decision?
I would think one of two things. Either leave Nicholsville where it is, but I think the people of Nicholsville would be better served if the city of Seattle found another location that they can freely gather as they please, the way they are doing it now. And there are many, many abandoned schools, and there are many, many school properties that are just owned by the school district. I know of many in my neighborhood that they just sit on and then finally sell. But anyway, the city should work to find something that is, for instance, owned by the school district or owned by some other public entity, and relocate them there. And I would think an abandoned school would be ideal, and also set up these community help organizations that try to help the homeless and try to get them help, allow them to set up there and to work with the homeless at the location. But yeah, I think it's totally wrong to shut it down. Either relocate it or leave it where it is.
We have heard a lot about the cities trying to grapple with transportation issues. What direction do you think the city of Seattle should go when it comes to transportation planning?
Well, I think that unfortunately this city is totally enamored by the idea of rapid transit and particularly light rail. And I think that is wrong because, unfortunately, this started 20, 30 years ago where they tried to get people out of the cars into rapid transit, and the results have been very poor. There's only maybe 10 to 20% of the people that use rapid transit, and the rest of the people prefer to use their cars. So I think more concentration on improving roads and access for motor vehicles is more important than the transit issues. And light rail is a very poor alternative because it costs so much money and it is not flexible as far as being located exactly where people want to go. So I would say do more for the buses and make bus service because they can go wherever they want and then find the best routes for them. And we've already committed to light rail. Let's just stop that and stop spending money on that because it's an astronomical sum of money, which really is not worth it. Okay.
Related to that, there is implicit criticism of Mayor McGinn in your comments because that's been his emphasis. How would you assess overall his 4 years in office, 3.5 years in office?
Well, he has said himself, there's no school for mayors and it's a learning experience. And unfortunately, we elected a mayor who had no concept of the community and what's best for the community. And I just read the other day where he said, oh, I wish I had spent more time talking to community leaders. And that's been his problem. He's been ruling more like a somewhat of a semi-dictator and using his own personal pet projects that he pushes on the people of Seattle without truly assessing what the people of Seattle really want.
You tossed.
It's been poor, in other words. I don't think it's been good.
Yeah. You did enter this race almost at the very last minute. Why did you decide that you would toss your name in?
Well, I thought that I've lived my whole life in the Seattle area, mostly in Seattle, quite a bit right across the bridge in Bellevue, but spent a lot of time going to the University of Washington and then living in Seattle and working in Seattle. So Seattle is a love for me because I grew up here and I know everything about it for, I'm 68, so since I was as far back as I can remember. And so I thought community involvement and someone who really knows this city and can remember the times when we had things like Greater Seattle, where we had the leaders of Seattle get together and do everything they could to improve the quality of this city and to make this city a world-class city and a very livable city. And I thought I could do something about that because I've practiced law for 40 years, and I do have my own private businesses in West Seattle, and I know something about the business community, and I know that this city really needs and relies on attracting as much business as it can and do everything they can to make small businesses viable in this city without a ton of regulations and a ton of needless taxes and regulations that make it almost impossible for a small business person to operate, but mainly to help the people of Seattle to have what they want, which I believe is affordable housing and having a good way of living and jobs. And the only way you get jobs is to attract business.
You haven't.
And I want to be part of that. I just thought it would be nice to get involved in community involvement. And it's been a kind of a passion of mine for my whole life to hopefully someday get in and help and be somewhat of a leader or a guider. I don't want to really lead from the top down. I want to come from the bottom up, from the people. I want to listen to the people and to all the various community groups and organizations and grassroots of Seattle. And because I've been so dissatisfied with the way this city has been run.
You haven't been really an active campaigner. You haven't been at many of the candidate forums.
No, I haven't.
Are you going to be more visible in the final weeks of the campaign?
I'm hoping to, but that's yet to be seen how active I get. I've been somewhat non-active because it's my policy. It really bothers me that elections are won by money and by politicians, and we keep electing the same politicians over and over again, and I just want to be an ordinary citizen grown up here and accomplished a lot in the development of this city and seen it develop and just sit back, put my name in there and say, I don't want to be controlled by special interests like so many of the others are. Most of them have been in political office and they had to announce a party, and this is a nonpartisan office. So, you know, I'm part Democrat, part Republican, part Libertarian. I will listen to all sides. And I don't want to accept money, and it really bothers me the way people say that people are not serious in running for office because they haven't raised a lot of money.
Are you planning to spend any money on?
As little as possible, I don't want people to give me money because favoritism and potential conflicts of interest. And then you have special interests controlling you through their pocketbook. And I don't agree with that. I think, you know, when the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution, they didn't expect that money would control elections and elections could be bought.
Mr. McQuaid, this is the last question. I know you have to get back to work, but should you make it through the primary and should you be elected mayor, what would be the first thing that you do?
Oh, the first thing would be to start spending hours and hours looking through the various books and records and seeing where we can reduce taxes, unnecessary taxes and unnecessary personnel, and try to balance the budget and try to find money to put into projects that are really beneficial for the people of Seattle, not just for the government of Seattle or for the government people or for certain special interests, but rather what's going to benefit the whole general public. And the first thing I would do is try to find funding by reducing costs of the city.
Mr. McQuaid, I really appreciate your time. Is there anything else that you want to add?
Well, I just want to add, I'm one of the few candidates that was born at Swedish Hospital in 1945, and I grew up on Capitol Hill, and then I moved right across the bridge to Bellevue, and then I moved back to Seattle, and I had my whole job career here. And I just want to add, I'm a lawyer. I went to Willamette Law School, the same as Governor Inslee, who he started the year after I did. But anyway, I'm the only candidate who has actually stepped up and served their country in the military. There's all this stuff about praising your military people, and military need jobs. That's another thing I would do is give jobs in the city government to military people who are running somewhere around 40% unemployed. Wherever there's jobs that can be given to military people who have served their country, great. And I stepped up and served my country, and I served in a war, and I was in combat, and I was highly decorated. That's all I got.
Douglas McQuaid is one of 9 people running to be Seattle mayor. We caught up with him by cell phone on his way to work at Seattle Municipal Court. We're talking with all 9 candidates on KUOW's Weekday and The Conversation. Tune around noon today. You can hear conversation with Mary Martin. All the interviews are going to be archived at our website, kuow.org/elections. And you can listen Thursday evening at 7 for a live mayoral candidate debate hosted by KCTS Television, simulcast on KUOW. The primary election's August 6th. Ballots go out in the mail this week. I'm Marcy Silman.
And just a quick clarification, if you go to kuow.org/elections, that's not going to find the information for you. What you need to do is go to kuow.org, and then at the top of the page where it says government, click on that or hover over that, and then click on elections. Simple as that. 1024, I'm Bernard Ouellette. The hidden dangers of beauty products in a minute. 76 degrees in Seattle. It's mostly sunny. Forecast says it'll be sunny all day with a high of 88. Keep your garden thriving through the summer with the help of our gardening experts, who will join us here in 20 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. We all use a lot of products every day to stay clean and attractive. Lotion, shampoo, deodorant, face cream, sunblock, cosmetics. All of these things are very commonplace. But do we have any idea what's in them? Shampoos often contain sulfites and parabens, which can be hormone disruptors. Lotions contain propylene glycol, which can be also used to make antifreeze. Chemicals in some sunscreens are linked to cancer in women. So in a complicated world of long and unknown chemical names, what can we use to stay clean and attractive without hurting our bodies inadvertently? And why aren't these products better regulated? Siobhan O'Connor is a journalist and feature editor for Good Magazine in New York City, and she joins us on the phone. Hi there, Siobhan.
Hello.
Hi there. Thanks for joining us. And then also with us is Alexandra Spunt, a journalist and marketing consultant in Los Angeles. Together, they are co-authors of the book No More Dirty Looks, The Truth About Your Beauty Products and the Ultimate Guide to Safe and Clean Cosmetics. So, Siobhan, in your book, you say that if a person bathes daily, they could be exposed to up to 1,000 different chemicals every day. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of startling when you first hear it. But to put it into context, every product that we use, take a shampoo, a conditioner, can contain up to, between 20 and 50 different ingredients. And on average, they say that women use between 9 and 12 products every day. But the truth is, when you actually ask people to count on their fingers, it ends up being more like 20. And for men, it's about 11. So add all of that up, and your chemical exposure is actually quite high, even before you leave the house in the morning.
Yeah, I was counting up mine today, and I always thought I had a very simple regimen. And then I realized that I probably used about 10 different things this morning. So there you are.
Yeah.
So how
even low maintenance people tend to use a lot more than they realize.
So how did you both start researching this?
It all started a couple of years ago. Alexandra is, she's my best friend, and she lives in Los Angeles, and I live in New York, and we frequently visit each other, and whenever we would try to do something sort of nice together. So one time I was visiting her, and we had a big party to go to, and she thought it would be a great idea for us to get this new salon treatment called the Brazilian Blowout, which at the time was sort of relatively unknown. She had read about it in a magazine. It has since become quite popular and quite controversial. But yeah, we basically went for this hair treatment and ended up having a sort of allergic reaction during it. We were coughing. They gave us goggles, which, to be quite honest, we didn't even really think about at the time. We were more concerned with, you know, just sort of enjoying ourselves later that day. But a couple weeks later, we decided to dig into, well, what was going on? Alexandra's hair, she has like this big mass of curly hair, and it started looking really kind of rough around the edges, and the smell was still there. And we thought, how is this possible that a salon treatment would have effects that last this long and smell for this long? So we looked into it and found out that the secret ingredient in what we thought was a natural keratin hair treatment was actually formaldehyde, which is a carcinogen. So from there, we were incredibly startled, and it just sort of, you know, led to, we were both journalists, so it led to obvious follow-up questions of how is that even possible that formaldehyde would be allowed in a hair treatment? How is that legal? Why would it be used in the first place? Are there any safeguards in place? And we found that, you know, the cosmetics industry is basically a wild west when it comes to regulation, and there are all kinds of things in all of our products, from fancy salon treatments to the shampoo and nail polish and face lotion, anti-agers, whatever you want to use every day, that there are all kinds of things in there that perhaps we're better off not using.
I think Alexandra's with us now. Are you there, Alexandra?
I think so. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
I am here.
Okay, great. Well, maybe you could give us some examples of some of the unexpected chemicals or additives that we would find in those commonplace products you were just saying, like shampoo and lotion and these things that we're rubbing all over our bodies.
Sure. I mean, there's a whole whack of them, but they tend to repeat themselves through products. That was also something interesting that we discovered. Your body wash has a lot more in common with your shampoo than you would imagine. Shampoo specifically has something called sodium lauryl sulfate and sodium laureth sulfate, which has gotten a lot of airplay because it's the stuff that makes the product foam, that feeling we all love so much. But it can be contaminated with a carcinogen, and it's also, of course, used in any products that foam, so including baby products, body washes, shampoo, different types of soaps. It's all over the place. Other ones are endocrine disruptors like phthalates, which are found in fragrance. Most products contain fragrance, and most fragrances contain phthalates. Something called parabens, which has also been known to be an estrogen mimicker. So all of these sort of strange science fiction chemicals are popping up in all of these products.
So are any of these products actually directly linked to disease? Because I think it's easy for us to hear all these words and say, oh, you know, I'm only using them a little bit. What does it matter?
It's very hard to find conclusive evidence when you're talking about these tiny doses, and it's very hard to test for tiny doses over long periods of time. But there is starting to be some really compelling research showing that exposing ourselves to some of these products, even in small amounts, can change the body in ways that we don't want it to be changed. It's mounting evidence, but it's hard.
Can you give an example of how the body might change?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to endocrine disruptors, we know that hormones are extremely sensitive and can be affected by very small shifts. So there's a whole body of research around this stuff now that shows, for instance, well, it's always hard to say shows or proves, but a woman we know, a scientist, did a study on baby boys, and it showed that there was increased risk of hypospadia, which is a type of genital deformity at birth, in baby boys when their mothers were exposed to higher levels of phthalates.
Interesting.
So there's starting to be human research now that's a little bit disconcerting.
Let me run a scenario by you. Maybe, Siobhan, you can take this. Something you commonly see when you're out to eat at a restaurant. is a woman finishing her meal and then putting on a new application of lipstick when she's done. What, after doing all this research, do you see when you see that scenario?
I mean, that's an amazing example, and it's something that we talk about in the book, and we encourage people to think about. You know, if you put on lipstick and then the lipstick is gone, where do you think it went? I mean, some of it either went on the fork and stuck to your food, and then you ingested it that way. Some of the ingredients can penetrate the skin and get in the body that way, and some of it, if you're lucky, are just wiping off on a napkin. But you know, the truth is that By some standards of measure, we absorb up to 60% of what we put on our bodies. That statistic is sort of controversial. People debate it left and right. But the point is, when you put something on your body, even like a lotion, let's say, it's not still sitting on the surface of your skin 3 minutes later. That means some of it's going in and some of it's evaporating. And you know, when it comes to lipstick is a tricky one. And the FDA is one of the few things that they actually looked at closely, and of every single lipstick that they studied, they found lead in all of them. Lead, obviously, is a neurotoxin. Now, lead is not there as an intended ingredient, so this is where you can get a little bit lost in the weeds. Nobody is deliberately putting lead in a lipstick, but it so happens that it's in almost all of them. So if you're reapplying your lipstick all day, every single day, and wearing the same one for 20 years, I mean, that's where we sort of say, why bother? You know, if you can't be sure that something is safe and there are alternatives out there that are better, why wear a lipstick that has lead in it? Or a shampoo with a formaldehyde releaser in it, or, you know.
If beauty companies know that some of the products or some of the chemicals in their products are dangerous, what is their intent? Are they taking the risk of possibly making people sick or knowingly making people sick like cigarette companies did, or is that too dramatic of a comparison?
Some people use that comparison. It's hard to say if it's entirely fair. When we were researching the book, you know, we spoke to a lot of people who had a lot of good intentions, and I think it can become that sort of thing where when you're used to something, and this has been the doctrine, I think a lot of people at the companies believe that the amounts are too small to harm people, but it's hard to speak for everyone. And certainly now, as the research becomes more evolved, that's starting to not quite hold water anymore.
Siobhan, did you have something you wanted to add?
I guess the only thing I would add to that is that, you know, when it comes to the argument, when you're talking to toxicologists and cosmetics formulators, is always, you know, does the dose make the poison? And that's sort of long been the defense of the cosmetics industry. We're only using these things in very small amounts. There is no problem. Nobody should worry. And then, you know, more conservative toxicologists will say, you know, that might not be the case. As we're seeing with endocrine disruptors, for instance, hormone disruptors, smaller amounts actually can produce more harm in the body than larger amounts. So the rules are just not quite so hard and fast.
What is a hormone disruptor? Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, they're synthetic chemicals that when they're absorbed into the body, they either mimic or block hormones that naturally occur in the body. So something like parabens, for instance, which you hear a lot about, these are preservatives that are very, very widely used in personal care products. I would say the most popular face wash out there, which is recommended by dermatologists all over the country, has 6 ingredients in it, and 3 of those are parabens, which are, like I said, synthetic preservatives. And parabens have been shown in study after study to be estrogenic. Now, this is a bit of a concern because if you're using, because parabens are so widely used, if you're using, like you said, 10 products before you leave the house in the morning, and there are parabens in all of those, and you're using them every day, as Alexandra said, we're never going to have concrete proof that, you know, your face wash caused X or your shampoo caused Y. But as scientists are starting to make these connections, the evidence is mounting that, you know, there should be cause for concern, and it's quite easy to replace these things. And so let's go ahead and do that.
We're speaking with Siobhan O'Connor and Alexandra Spunt, who are the authors of No More Dirty Looks, The Truth About Your Beauty Products and the Ultimate Guide to Safe and Clean Cosmetics. So can either of you explain why it is that companies are using these products if they're dangerous? Why are they even in there at all?
I mean, you have to really look back at the history, which is something that we do early on in the book. It's just been it's been unregulated or self-regulated, as the industry likes to say, for so long now that it would be so expensive to go back, to change the way these products are tested, to create a full department at the FDA that's in charge of regulating these products, because it's been like this for 100 or so years. And it's just one of those industries, and it's not the only one, that's kind of gotten out of control at this point. You know, there's about, what is it, something like 10,000 chemicals on the books in beauty products. It's impossible to know how all of those chemicals are going to react in the body, how they react when they're together. It becomes so exponential when you look at the variables that it's frightening. And this is why when we first started looking into this that we said, you know, we have to figure out a way to find products that we know are clean and safe instead of trying to figure out which products are safer than other ones, because it's impossible science.
Before everybody who's listening goes home tonight and throws out every single thing that they have in their cabinets in the bathroom, what should they be looking for as far as the labels are concerned, and what items should they throw away? What's the most dangerous thing that they could find?
Unfortunately, we get asked this all the time, and there are no exactly hard and fast rules, but we would say definitely don't freak out, don't throw out everything at once. We encourage people to start with two very simple steps. The first would be to look at your shampoo, conditioner, assuming you use those every day. If you don't, then maybe not, and a body lotion. Basically anything you use over a large surface area of your body, such as a lotion, a body wash or shampoo, these things that we just are constantly exposing ourselves to that are often filled with garbage that aren't doing anything for your skin, your looks. They're not good for you, and they are loaded with all of these sort of sketchy ingredients that we've been talking about. And those are all very, very easy to replace with non-toxic, you know, just a few ingredients, very, very simple. So that would be, you know, maybe step one. And then step two is start taking a look at ingredient lists. Obviously, this can get a little bit overwhelming. We were overwhelmed when we first started, but you look at ingredient lists, it's, you know, they're quite long and they're full of words you don't recognize. But go to near the bottom of the list and see if the word fragrance is on there, and you'll find it often is. Fragrance is a good thing when you're ready to start eliminating from the products that you use, because of trade secret laws, fragrance is a sort of catch-all term for a huge question mark. There's no way for the consumer to know what chemicals are being used in the formulations of fragrance, but we do know that there are often phthalates, which are these hormone disruptors we've been talking about, in almost all fragrance. They're also irritants, so a lot of people find that when they make these two simple switches, their mysterious rashes go away, you know, spots on their skin, things that people thought was eczema. I mean, these things just kind of go away, because there are a lot of things that, whether or not they're, you know, messing with your hormones or carcinogenic, can cause really bad skin irritation, chronic skin irritation.
If we want to replace some of these products with stuff that's better for us or more natural, what is the price point on something like that? Is that going to be a little bit more bank breaking?
It's interesting because, yes, certain really high quality natural products are more expensive than mainstream products. But when you look at the ingredients in the natural products versus the mainstream products, you'll see in the mainstream products that 90% of the product is what we call fillers. The first ingredient is water, and then it's a list of preservatives, essentially. And they put a drop of aloe vera or shea butter. And when you buy the natural product, you'll see that the first ingredient will be the aloe vera or the shea butter. So you're getting more bang for your buck. And what we also realized, I've probably cut out more than half of the products I was using before. Because once you see that the same ingredients are appearing everywhere, and that ultimately when we use a very stripping shampoo, we're forced to use more conditioners, more leave-in products. When you scrub that top layer of skin off with an exfoliant, you're forced to use more body lotions, more creams. When you get a bit more in touch with what your body responds best to, and you start feeding it great ingredients through the skin, you don't need as many products. So we found ourselves in a situation where in some cases we were paying a little bit more for specific products we were really attached to, but overall, overall, we were actually saving money because we were using far fewer products. So great DIY products. For instance, coconut oil, which is some organic coconut oil. We use it to shave our legs, take off makeup. I use it on the tips of my hair. So there's also these great DIY tricks that we talk about that are great money savers, too.
I know that a lot of times people are willing to take more risks with their health when it comes to beauty. It's almost like in our brains it gets displaced a little bit. Are there any risks that you two find that you're still willing to take after doing all these research, all this research?
Honestly, I mean, not okay. So the honest answer to that is we both have gotten highlights once in the last year. So, you know, that's one thing that we'll do. I still get manicures. I use something that doesn't have, you know, the sort of the worst offending chemicals in it. But I do enjoy getting my nails done sometimes. So there are certain things that we do, but definitely nothing in our kit, nothing at home, nothing that we're using every day or even with any frequency. And that's because, and people don't always believe us when we say it, but literally we love everything that we've switched to more. And we sound like evangelists when we say it, but it's true. Like the new products outperform by every standard of measure the ones that we were using before. So it's not really a trade-off. Nature can't really give you golden highlights, though. So we get those occasionally.
Siobhan O'Connor is a journalist and feature editor for Good Magazine in New York, and Alexandra Spunt is a journalist and marketing consultant in Los Angeles, the co-authors of the book No More Dirty Looks, The Truth About Your Beauty Products and the Ultimate Guide to Safe and Clean Cosmetics. Thanks to you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, right now the thermometer in our studio says it's 77 degrees. It's sunny outside. It is full-on summer. Gardens around the Puget Sound are bursting with blooms. And mine isn't, but other people's are bursting with produce. Our panel of gardening experts is here once again to answer your questions. And they are Greg Rayburn, Vashon Basin Stewart, co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk, Laura Matter, a practicing horticulturalist and coordinator of Seattle Tilth's Garden Hotline, and garden and travel writer Marty Wingett. Thanks again. And got a lot of emails, but let me give out the phone number, which is 206-543-5869. And Marcia, who sent her email at about 7 this morning, has the same problem as me. My tomato plants are large and healthy. They have lots of blossoms, but few result in fruit. We've been having nights in the 40s. She's in Squim, but I keep my plants covered, so what's up?
Oh, fruit
it's
is dependent
too
on
hot or yeah. too cold.
Yeah, but it's also dependent on pollination. So if that's not happening, you're not going to get any fruit.
Get out there and shake that plant.
You can. You know, the Urban Pollination Project, a couple students or folks from UW are working on studying bees and pollination. And one of the things they've done is give people three plants. One's covered in a net, one that you leave alone, and the other one you actually use a tuning fork. So get a tuning fork, go out there. That vibration mimics the vibration of a bumblebee.
Wow.
And will knock the pollen out.
Does it have to be in any particular key or
I
note?
I don't know.
Oh, wow. Maybe I should try that. But I actually don't have a lot of blossoms at all. And before we went on the air, you told me we just can't win. It was too hot.
Yeah.
But fruit won't set on tomatoes if it's too hot, which is really irritating because, of course, that's what we think we want. We want heat.
If a tuning fork would work, I wonder if an electric guitar and an amp would work as well.
I'm going to get a bumper crop of tomatoes if I go perform for them. Diane emails, my strawberries are finished. Should I cut them back now or wait till fall? And whenever I do it, how far down should I cut?
Oh, gosh. You know, I don't cut my strawberry plants back. I thin them. So I will keep some of the newer plants and get rid of the older ones as I go. And I do that every couple of years. I know commercial growers go through and mow them down, but I don't think you really need to worry about that in a home garden. They're awfully pretty plants. They actually are kind of decorative, and you don't really want to stress them out too much, I don't think.
So if you would dig up the oldest clump, do you then reposition the little plantlets that have hopped around?
Exactly, yeah, because they'll grow wherever, you know, they land, but you just remove an old one and put a new one back in its place.
Andrea has a related strawberry question. Hi, gardening experts. I have a little
4x4 foot patch of strawberries of unknown variety in a space that gets some afternoon sun. They're in a deep bed of nice soil amended with compost. They're beautiful, red, juicy berries, quite prolific, although they have slowed down this week. My problem is that they aren't very sweet. Is it a varietal issue or a growth issue? Should they be in a sunnier spot? I'm thinking of getting rid of them after the summer and looking into a better variety if that's the problem. Any recommendations for good varieties that grow well here?
Well, just some afternoon sun might not be enough for the traditional strawberries that we think about. But, Marcy, you know what kind of strawberry would grow well there.
The kind that a bird sends a seed down. I have little wild tiny strawberries. Yeah. And it's true, they're not big sweet things.
They're sweet, but they're tiny.
They're tiny, but they're not. They're tart-ish, but well, they're sweet.
But they're woodland strawberries, Fragaria vesca. And that's what we have. And I just love them. I know you're not going to get bowlfuls of.
But they're fun. I go outside and pick them because they're, it just so happened that the bird or whoever put the seed, put it into a big whiskey barrel that I plant in. And
well planted.
And
bird.
They come back every year and they're better every year and there's more berries than ever before. So they take shade. I hardly get any sun in my yard.
My favorite one outside of course, I'm a fan of the native strawberries, but my favorite cultivar is called Rainier, and it comes on all at once, so everything's ripe, so you have to get out there and pick them, but they are the best tasting berries, so I really enjoy them.
There are differences in the varieties, too. We had two different kinds in my pea patch. We actually got rid of the one because it was the bigger, juicier, beautiful red berry, but it didn't have much flavor compared to the smaller ones.
So what's your favorite, Laura?
I don't know which ones these are, so I couldn't tell you. We inherited them.
And neither does she. we're talking strawberries or any other kind of plant question you have with our Green Days Gardening Panel, 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Jane joins us from the Key Peninsula. Hi, Jane.
Hello, Marcy. I have a question about my sweet peas. I was growing sweet peas in Seattle, and they were all white. I specifically chose them to be white. At the end of the season, I gathered up all the seeds, and then I moved to Long Branch, which is at the bottom of the Key Peninsula, and I planted my seeds, and the first blooms were white, and now they're all dark pink. Is this a question of the soil?
Oh, no, I don't think it's the soil. I think that it's just the hybrid. The cultivar chosen has reverted to something else.
And so that
On every single plant, and I've got about 70 plants.
I'd say that that
all have gone to pink.
That color is stronger than the white. So if you want white every single year, you're going to need to buy Castles of May or whatever it was you chose.
Sweet peas are annuals, right?
Yes, they are.
And so that is why they would revert to whatever their native gene trait is?
Yes.
I've had this problem, too. I planted red ones, and then they turned pink.
They were red the first year.
Oh, yeah, beautiful.
Yeah.
And fragrant. Yeah. And they were less fragrant as the years went by.
Yes. Cultivars are often bred for fragrance and obviously color and size.
And then they'll just turn pink. Jane, thanks for your call. 1-800-289-5869. Dave's on Queen Anne Hill. Hi. Dave?
This is Dave. Thank you for taking my call. I'm kind of heartbroken because 2 years ago, my son made 2 55-gallon drums of hard apple cider. And he never did get around to finishing it, so I thought it was time to clean it up, which I did. And I thought it would be great to put on my plants, but it killed them all.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm really heartbroken. Some of the plants were really tough plants, like killed the bamboo. It killed my blueberry bushes.
You might want to contact the noxious weed board about this.
I thought they could use it. I was just thinking that you've come up with a great solution, Dave. So is your question how to revive your garden?
Well, I have two questions. I don't think we can revive a dead plant. I'm a beginner, so I'm sure I couldn't do it. Although the bamboo is coming back a little bit, but I'm wondering if I could use the the soil to replant.
Boy.
I would suspect that maybe the whatever it was, it may have been an acidity thing, and maybe the cider reverted to more of a cider vinegar. And vinegar is sometimes used as a herbicide. And if that's the case, you might want to do a pH test on the soil and just see. I wouldn't expect it to be a long-term soil contamination issue. But
you may need to wait until the rains have washed some of it through.
Yeah.
The rains meaning the fall rains.
Yes, the fall rains.
Which is a great time to be replanting anyway.
Yes,
so.
That's right.
So, Dave, just hang in there and wait, but try again after it rains. Try again with this soil.
Well, yeah, I
do another test.
Oh,
yeah,
test
Greg's
it.
Idea
test.
Is a good one.
pH.
Okay, so Dave, do you know how to do a pH test?
No, do I do that myself with just a kit?
I haven't heard great reviews of those soil test kits
that you can buy yourself.
The cheap ones, anyway. I don't know about the. I know you can get the soil probes. That do pH. I don't know.
I haven't tried those.
Reviews of that? Yeah. But a lot of people just send their, I mean, the most reliable is sending your soil sample in.
To whom?
The King Conservation District does free soil testing for King County. And you'll get a lot of other information out of that, so it's worth doing.
So he should go to the King
Conservation District website and Google the soil test.
It's kingcd.org, and that's the letter CD.
Okay. Good luck with that, Dave. Thanks for your call. Rico says, is giant Japanese butter burr okay to grow? It's the one that resembles wild ginger, but the leaves are 3 feet across. My neighbor has one. It's unreal.
Well, they are aggressive plant pedicides. They're related to our butter burr. It's related to our coltsfoot. Mm-hmm. It's in the same genus, but they are often pondside plants, big round leaves, bigger leaves than our coltsfoot.
Well, when you say aggressive, does that mean it's a noxious weed?
No, it just is aggressive in the garden. I don't think it's a noxious weed.
I don't think it's something that's been escaping to our wild areas.
It is an aggressive garden plant.
Okay, so if you don't mind that it's aggressive, you can grow it?
If you don't mind.
And I know one of those Japanese, I don't know if it's that one, but one of the Japanese pedicides is very edible, and it's often... So I don't. That'd be something to look into, because that's always a fun way to control plants.
Is to eat them. Yeah, that's for sure. A few more minutes with our gardeners, Tony in Bellevue. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, while I was just waiting for my call to be taken, I missed part of your conversation. You may have already answered my question, but we have a couple of garden plots that now we've for some trees that small trees that were blocking some sun. We have sufficient sunlight, but they don't seem to do real well for cultivating, but maybe some bush beans. This year, also the peas that we've put in are not real doing real well. We can't get lettuce to take real well. I'm just curious, and maybe it's a soils test for us as well, but we just recently fertilized, and that's greened some things up, but I don't know that it's making them really flourish.
Yeah, soil tests are always a good idea, especially if you're growing veggies, just to see what kind of pH you have, how much organic matter you have in there, how much nitrogen in particular in the soil. Most of these things need a lot of nitrogen to grow, and so adding some good organic fertilizer will be helpful. And you might do that for now and then do a soil test this fall and see how it looks.
Add some manure and then to it, and then a little bit of Miracle-Gro, and so far... cucumbers and zucchinis and things like that. The plants have become nice and green, but I'm curious to know if they're going to mature enough in the process of the...
Yeah, I would avoid the Miracle-Gro if I were you. I'd use a good organic fertilizer. The manure is good. It's lots of nitrogen, but...
Okay.
How much sunlight do you get now that you've pruned back some of the trees?
Say it again, please.
How much sunlight do you get?
I would say from 10 a.m. to probably 6 p.m., something like that.
That's plenty.
Yeah. Well, so do the soil test.
It's probably your soil, yeah. You need to refresh your soil in some manner.
Good luck with that, Tony. We're going now to Beacon Hill, where Allison's been on hold. Hi, Allison.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. I have an Asian pear tree. We just moved to a new house. And I have no experience with fruit trees. So I noticed the other day on a section of the new growth from this year, there were a lot of little black dots that were maybe aphids and ants crawling all over this one little branch. I'm wondering what that might be and what I could do about it. My solution was to cut it off and throw it in the compost, but I'm suspecting that they'll come back, whatever.
I would take a really strong spray of the hose, just water, and knock them off. It sounds like they're aphids.
Yeah, the ants are using your tree as open range territory for farming aphids. So they are running them out there, and they are protecting them while getting the wonderful juices that aphids excrete.
Because ants like to eat aphids, right?
No, they like the honeydew.
They like the honeydew from the aphid.
Mm-hmm. They're like their dairy cows.
Yeah. Truly, they do.
So you have an aphid farm, Allison. So squirt.
Oh, that's so lovely.
But you don't have to cut the branch off. Just really hard spray of water, and do it every few days, and you'll keep them under control.
Good luck with that. Thanks for your call. And the last email, Elaine says, I've picked all my artichokes. I have scraggly leaves and stalks left. Can I cut them down now? And do I need to keep watering?
Yes, water. And yes, cut the stalks down.
So do you cut everything down, all the leaves, or do you cut it down to that last set of leaves?
You'll see that there's a basal set of leaves. There's sort of a clump at the bottom. Yeah. Leave those leaves and cut the big, long stalks
down. But keep watering. So all through the summer.
Yep.
Okay.
Keep it healthy.
All right, Elaine. We are going to have summer for a little while at least.
And I guess.
We'll all be outside enjoying it. I won't be. I'll be in here. But you guys can go outside and enjoy it.
We'll tell you about it, Marcy.
Marty Wingett writes about gardens and travel at her website, martywingett.com. And she's written many books. You'll find the titles at that website. Laura Matter is a practicing horticulturalist, coordinator of Seattle Tilth's Garden Hotline. Greg Rayburn, Vashon Basin steward, co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. Thanks once again.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Tomorrow, we talk with mayoral candidates Charlie Stedeker and Bruce Harrell. Hope you can join us for Weekday.
KUOW's Weekday program begins tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Mary Martin is also a candidate for mayor of Seattle. She's with the Socialist Workers Party, and you can hear an interview with her today during the noon hour. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Sodo Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor organic garden supplies and hydroponics, featuring organic bison soil, sanctuary soils, and cutting-edge solutions, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sodohydro.com.
For a decade now, there's been a massive effort to defeat malaria in Africa. The plan? Distribute millions of insecticide-treated bed nets that repel and kill mosquitoes. But in some areas, those nets are starting to fail. The insecticide in them, it's not killing mosquitoes like it used to. A resurgence of the deadly disease may be coming. Can it be avoided? Our story next time on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Gilbert and Sullivan Society, presenting The Gondoliers, or The King of Barataria, where three...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.